Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Today is Walnut Wednesday, so we're featuring Taylor Chalstrom and this interview on walnuts.
This segment was sponsored by the California Walnut Board.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today we're talking with UCCE IPM advisor Jalendra Rijal about Pacific flathead borer's emergence as a significant pest in walnut and management tools for this pest. Welcome back, Jalendra.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Jalendra, can you tell me a little bit about the pest itself, Pacific flathead borer in general? You know, what is its biology? Let's start off with that.
Yeah, the Pacific flat-headed borer is really the pest that, as the name itself tells, it's the wood-boring insect. The larval stage of these, it's actually the adult is the beetle, small, about, you know, 3/4 of inch of that size beetle. And the larval stage of that beetle is actually the borer, which basically feed on the wooden part of the any plants in that matter. It's more common in walnuts now we're seeing as a problem, but they feed on almonds, any other fruit trees. But essentially it's a wood boring beetle larva, what we refer as flat-headed borer. The other thing about this is it's a whole group of insect within that sort of family. They all are wood boring beetles. And their larva all look kind of more or less similar, and they have this sort of flattened sort of interior part of their body, and that's why it generally referred as flat-headed borer. But there are multiple species of that. The species that is causing problem in walnuts that now we know it's the Pacific flat-headed borer. That's a one species. So that's just a little bit of the, on that introduction side. But if you think about the overall biology of this pest, these are the beetles. The adult female will basically, in the summertime, they lay eggs on walnuts, wooded part of the walnut, which could be branches or in the younger trees, it would be the trunks of the walnuts. And whatever they get opportunity to have a small bark, the opening or any kind of cracks or any sunburn type of damage in the walnuts, whenever they see those opportunity, then female lay eggs there. And from there, that larva basically goes inside the wood, basically feeding on the cambium layer and slowly moving to the sort of the internal part of the wood, very, very hard wood inside the wood, and then and cause damage. So essentially, this larva is basically feeding on that cambium layer. And because of that, it makes that smaller branch weaker, and whenever there is, wind pressure or any kinds of the smaller sort of gust of wind, and that branch it's tend to break. And if there are a lot of infestation in the orchard, you can see a lot of flagged branches. That's for the mature orchard, but for the young orchard, for the young trees that planted the first leaf or second leaf, those trunks are still small in size, and whenever the flathead borer feed on those trunks, they tend to basically wilt that whole plant and cause damage. So it's once the pressure is there in the orchard, then it tend to go do a pretty serious economic damage.
Since they're kind of boring into the wood there and causing the weakened branches, I mean, that could probably be confused with a lot of other things, if I'm assuming correctly there.
Yeah, that's one of the things that when we started this this flat-headed borer and start finding out more and more about the flat-headed borer and infestation in walnut orchard, that back in 2018, that's the year when there are a lot of growers and PCAs from the, especially in the northern San Joaquin Valley counties, they reported some sort of like unusual pattern of these damage that is occurring in the walnut orchard. And then that draw our attention. Of course, I and other farm advisor from the area, also that there are some USDA scientists at that time also involved, and they would try to see what's the real problem. And we visited several orchards, and we see the more or less similar pattern on those orchards, and we're able to actually found the larva inside those branches. And at that time, we were kind of like loosely saying that it's a flat-headed borer because we did not know exactly what species is causing that. But later, we were able to identify the specific pest that is actually causing in the problem in the walnuts as a Pacific flat-headed borer. So that's how it started. And after that point, of course, it draw attention from us and also from the because of the grower. We also talked about this in the walnut research conference and also with the California Walnut Board. And we were able to gather some funding sources and to look at at least you understand a little more about this pest and how it spread and those aspects. And that point that we're sort of in the, that's where we start finding out what kind of damage they do actually in the orchard. And in that case, we realized that many of these orchards have flat-headed borer. They have been dealing with it, but mostly on the symptom side, not knowing it's because of the flat-headed borer. Because sometimes when you see these flag branches, you can blame it's, you know, it may be the canker in the wood, and then because of that it break, or any other causes that might, right? So that those might be some of the causes, like the disease, and then that caused that branch to die. But when we start researching on this issue, and then we're finding the larva inside those branches, and we're able to, you know, provide the awareness to the industry that, hey, this is not just the disease you're thinking, it is something else is going on here. So I think it's that's why it's, if even at this time, you know, the grower, they may not have much information about the flat-headed borer. It's easily can get, you know, sort of mixed or confused with the other kinds of damage. That's the reason that we every time whenever we do the extension talk or write the article, we talked about, you know, closely monitor your orchard and then look at whether you are actually seeing the flat-headed borer damage, and which may not be related to any other things. It's just flat-headed borer causing damage.
We're going to be right back after a word from our sponsors.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow. Salty, closed soils can render your crops unproductive. DSAL, formulated by AgroPlanté, is specially designed for sodic and saline sodic soils. DSAL will displace sodium and wash it out of the root zone with irrigation to enhance your soil structure, water penetration, and vitality by decreasing soil salinity. AgroPlanté's DSAL flocculates your soil to promote soil aeration and drainage. With DSAL, you'll create a better soil environment for your crop roots and optimize yield. Contact AgroPlanté today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at agroplanté.com. AgroMiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, AgroMiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, AgroMiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Hi, we're back talking with UCCE IPM advisor Jalantra Bijal about Pacific flathead borer's emergence as a significant pest. The flathead borer is, like you said, it's a fairly recent pest in walnut. However, I've come to learn that it's not necessarily a new pest in agriculture in general. So I'm curious, you know, have you guys found any factors that might have potentially contributed to the borer's emergence in walnuts, or is it more just people kind of just started noticing it?
Yeah, that's really good question. Flat-headed borer, even though we start talking a lot more about this pest recently, but it's nothing new to the valley. So in fact, the flat-headed borer caused damage in the past in a lot of fruit trees, cherry fruit tree. We still hear a lot of flat-headed borer damage from cherry also. But relatively recently, in the last 5-6 years, we hear more of the flat-headed borer infestation in walnut. So something definitely have changed, and that triggered the flat-headed borer more issue in walnuts. So we don't know exactly what are the you know potential causes, but we can kind of, based on what we've seen, that there could be the multiple factors. One of them, I think it's walnut is more susceptible to a certain degree compared to the other trees. Whether it's because they have a lot of smaller branches, or maybe the softer the bark where they can easily do the damage. The other reason is that the flat-headed borer really needs some kind of avenue to get in, whether it's a sunburn of the branches, or whether it's some other, cracked branches or any other of those avenues. And so they basically tend to, cause damage from that point. And walnut might be the one that is much more susceptible in these issues, and then that's why they are more common in there. The other sort of like a general hypothesis I have is, you know, walnut acreage is increasing every year, like similar to other nut crops. And the walnuts nowadays, they are also in the area where it deemed to be not so much suitable in the past, right? So there are a lot of areas where there might be a little other factors, like stress factors out there. Still, the walnut production is happening on those relatively recently. And that might contribute to a certain degree that it provides a stress to the tree. And the stress trees is actually, somehow the flat-headed borer will be able to sense that, and they will do the damage. So and of course, you know, drier the conditions, higher the temperature, better for this beetle. They do really well on those dry heat conditions. In fact, it is known that similar flat-headed borer species, it is known that the female is attracted to the branch based on the temperature gradient, temperature differences in the branch. Whenever they see higher heat coming out, and that's where they go and lay eggs. So it is all what is happening in California, you know, with the drought and increased temperature, less winter, the temperature, and those kind of things probably contributed to that mix too. So it's a long answer, but there might be the multiple factors playing into role and make it a little more suitable for the flat-headed borer causing damage now.
Okay. I'm wondering if you can speak to this. Obviously, you know that there's been a pattern of freeze events over the past few years in walnuts. Maybe does some of that kind of later damage that is experienced from those freeze events, you know, in the spring and the summer, could that possibly play a role into it too, or are they not connected?
It is, of course, very plausible that whenever you see the freeze damage, so that means that there will be less, those branches are already susceptible. There will be less leaf, so they are already exposed to more to the sunlight. So that that factor is there. And whenever that dead branches is there without the leaves, that's maybe the very potential source for the flat-headed borer go and lay eggs. We have not looked at specifically looking at the, you know, the freeze damage versus the flat-headed borer, but it's very likely that whenever there is open area with the damaged wood, they will go in near to that and then feed on or lay their eggs. So it's with the increased concern of the freeze damage and we've seen in the past couple of years, I think that making those conditions making favorable for flat-headed borer too in general.
We're going to be right back after a word from our sponsors.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Hi, we're back talking with UCCE IPM advisor Jalandra Bijal about Pacific flathead borer's emergence as a significant pest in walnuts and management tools for this pest. Jalandra, I want to get into some of the flathead borer research that's occurring right now in the state. You're part of a USDA-funded project looking at monitoring and management tools for the Pacific flathead borer. I'm just curious, what have been some of the key findings in that research thus far?
Yeah, at least the based on what we know so far, based on the infestation that we have seen in the valley, it seems like everybody recognizes it's a growing problem. And because of that, Walnut Board actually started funding my research in 2018. And then we did have 1 year where we did basically document what kind of damage the flatheader would do, where we're seeing the damage, what the grower are saying about it, and what are the any other tools and options were there, explore those. So all that preliminary work basically in the 1 year that we did actually help us to be a part of this multi-state, the USDA NIFA grant that is administered through from the host institution in Tennessee State. But we're looking at 10 different states and have the flat-headed borer issue in multiple crops. It's not just a walnut, but walnut in California, similarly the hazelnut in Oregon, and there are a lot of nursery trees in the East Coast. So we're kind of coming together in this perfect timing, at least to understand a little more about these multiple species of the flat-headed borer and start doing some work. And I think, you know, fortunately we got pretty significant funding to look at these various different issues in flat-headed borer. Not only California, but other states too. In California, I'm leading that project, and we'll continue doing that. Next 2-3 years, even there is possibility extending up to 4 or 5 years. So that's a good part. At least we'll be able to gather some of the federal money and then start putting those money into the research and looking at this insect. The other aspect about that funding is, you know, before we don't still have a lot of information about flat-headed borer and its damage in walnuts. And so basic things, even we started with when these beetles occur in the orchard, when they are coming and doing a damage, how long they will fly before they start laying eggs, what time of the year that we need to think about, if we need to think about a treating those with the insecticide or any other option, if we have any. We don't have any yet, but we're going into that direction, at least looking at some of the insecticide and see whether there is potential to treat in some of these severely damaged orchards. And so a whole host of the things that are unknown at this point, but we'll start doing it one by one, at least addressing some of the biology related, some of the monitoring related issues. So one of the first thing that we did was we looked at the adult emergence from these branches. So a little bit of background on that. So whenever flat-headed borer feed on those branches in the summertime, so once they finish feeding late in the fall, they will go inside of that that branch where they feed on, and they basically overwinter as a larva on that branch. And then in the spring, they pupate inside the branch again, and then come back next year as a beetle, as an adult. So pretty much wintertime, they're spending time inside those branches. And so, but whenever they emerge adult in the next summer, we did not know when they start emerging. And that's the whole story will begin at that point, right? And we were able to at least figure that out based on various different research we did, you know, cut these branches, bring in a lab, and then look at the emergence of the adult from those in different time. The other thing that we did was we basically put these small fabric cages in the field where we see the infestation on those branches. We basically covered that part. And in the summer, every week we go there, look at the beetle emergence on those cages, because we put the cage, so that means the beetle would not be able to escape from there when they emerge. That gave us the confident result from last year and this year that, yeah, mid-June is the time when we see a lot of these beetles coming out from these infested branches. So that provides a pretty significant information in terms of what next step we could do if we target any adults at that time or larva at that time, you know, when the adult come out and then mate and then, you know, start laying eggs. For, you know, using insecticide, some other control technique. So that's the one of the biology that we were able to successfully done. This year also, we looked at some of the monitoring tools like a trap based on the other work done in similar species in other state, like forestry system and also then like nursery system. There are all other flat-headed borer species, they have some monitoring tools, and we try to replicate those for the flat-headed borer too. I have to admit that they didn't work that well so far, but this is the first year we're trying, and we're also testing some of the attractant that potentially we can use in the future. So this year trial, we did not get that many beetles in the traps, but again, this is just the words, just to start from the scratch. So it takes time to figure out what would be the best attractant, what trap we can use, and all that aspect. But we're going to that direction because that's the ultimate. Ultimately, we need to figure that out so that we know whether the beetles are present in the orchard, if they are present, when they start, flying actively, and if we can do something of the management side, then we'll know about the timing. The other aspect also in the future we'd like to focus on are, you know, understanding, of course, the more biology, ecology of this pest, plus also figure out some of the control options. whether, you know, in looking at the insecticidal options, and then insecticidal, if we do it, the timing, and all host of the things, which are still the, you know, the part of the integrated pest management, where we looked at the biology monitoring, as well as the figuring out the control options. Potentially we'll look at some of the biological control aspect too, because we have seen actually the one of the wasp, parasitic wasp, coming out from the branches where there was flat-headed borer coming out also. Okay. So there are some of these parasitoid species are wasp are active in the orchard too. We just need to figure out what level of control they're doing, and all other aspects of biocontrol too. So long story short, we don't have much information at this point. At least we know now that it's emergence timing in the summertime, and we're trying to do some of the monitoring tools, development of that, and then in the future we'll also test some of these control measures that potentially we can use.
Jalendra, that's all really great. Is there anything else that walnut growers should know regarding this pest? Anything we might not have covered maybe?
Yeah, of course we covered majority of the aspect about, you know, from including from biology and how to manage those. And in terms of the management, I want to add another thing, especially for the young trees. When there is, you know, first year of the trees, whenever, you know, we plant in the springtime, those trees are really, really highly susceptible to the sunburn and flat-headed borer damage same time. And so I think the best approach is whenever we plant these trees, we need to put these white paints on the trunk so that will prevent the sunburn as well as flat-headed borer infestation. It is serious. In some cases, I've seen the orchard, there is pretty much 80-90% of the damage occurred in these first year trees. So that's one of the things that we need to be paying attention very closely, because, you know, if you get that level of infestation, basically there is no option other than removing those trees. And then that already, not only the amount of the, you know, the economic loss in there on that from those trees, but also your planting and everything is pushed by, you know, 2 years or so, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one of the things that for the younger trees, it's really important to do that. At least first couple of years, to paint those trunks and on the young trees. Other thing that I want to say to the growers overall is that the flat-headed borer is not like a navel onion where you can go in every orchard and you'll find it, right? Mm, okay. Even that, some of the growers that are dealing with the flat-headed borer is dealing for a long time, and then it's a really difficult pest to manage. And many times also, whenever the flat-headed borer starts in a couple of years, you may not even notice that it's a flat-headed borer is occurring in your orchard. So you might be, you know, saying that it's probably the disease and other things, unless you looked at clearly, go there and find the symptoms of those flat-headed borer and look for the larva. And that's one thing that I want to encourage to the growers as well as pest control advisor. If you're seeing the smaller branches, dead branches, a lot flagged branches, pay attention and look for the symptoms. Look for those inside those branches on the bark and inside those smaller branches, and see whether you see any indication of feeding. You can see actually the larva inside. You can see the frass coming out from there. Many times you can see these brown color, the sort of like a liquid sort of spread on the bark in the branches. And so those are the sort of like early indications of the flat-headed borer. So pay attention to your orchard. If you have some of the branches that start dying or those kind of things, pay close attention. There might be the flat-headed borer establishing. So that's one of the things that I want to say, because sometimes it's easy, very easy to, you know, not detecting the flat-headed borer infestation And unless we, you know, closely pay attention to those infested places and look for flat-headed borer.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you, Jalendra, for providing some more context to this newer pest in walnut. While we might, you know, not have all the management tools we need for it at the moment, hopefully that research really comes up for that pest to give us some of those management tools. Thanks for talking about it today, Jalendra.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I'm very happy that we'll have this opportunity to provide some of these educational or the research-based information to the growers and to the pest control advisors that helps to detect not only the flat-headed borer, but many times manage in a long run. So happy to be a part of it.
Definitely. We appreciate you being here. This is Taylor with My Ag Life signing off.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you. Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Here's your news for today. What were some of the focal points and findings regarding USDA's latest edition of its Rural America at a Glance series of reports? Rod Bain reports.
The 2021 edition of USDA's annual Rural America at a Glance report focuses on two specific areas, according to research economist and co-author Elizabeth Dobis.
What's going on in rural America and how the characteristics of rural America may have affected the resiliency and recovery of rural communities in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. We wanted to focus on broadband in this year's edition of Rural America at a Glance because so much of our lives went online during the pandemic, and having good online access was really crucial.
Yet she acknowledges obtaining and analyzing data to craft this year's report and its findings, even from traditional sources, was more challenging due to the pandemic.
We've done the best that we can with the statistics that have been brought to us by the government agencies that we've been using. We've been using information from the 2020 census, as well as information on unemployment rates from the BLS, as well as some information on what has been going on prior to the pandemic.
First, on the pandemic front, research indicates the initial surge of COVID-19 cases in persistent poverty counties occurred in metropolitan areas. However, non-metro counties in the same category began to lead the nation in pandemic cases. Also,
we were seeing unemployment rates that were the highest that had been seen since the Great Depression, about 13.6% in rural areas and 14.6% in urban areas.
Yet rural unemployment has returned to pre-pandemic levels, while urban unemployment rates remain elevated. Turning to broadband and its adoption in rural areas, Dobis says pre-pandemic, 72% of rural populations had high-speed internet, compared to 90% in urban locales.
In rural areas that have persistently high poverty, only 63% of residents had that moderate or high-speed broadband internet access in their census block.
Almost 82% of rural households had wired broadband connection through cable, fiber optic, or DSL lines, compared to 56% of urban households, which relied more on cellular data plans. The report suggests federal programs focusing on increasing wired internet service in rural America, combined with a lower volume of cell towers in non-metro locales, contributed to the higher proportion of wired broadband in the rural U.S. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Corn harvest activities are nearing completion. Here's Stephanie Ho.
Open weather in the plains, Midwest, and South helped push corn harvest activities near completion for the 2021 season.
Because progress nationally has reached 95%, this will be the last look at the corn harvest for this season. With that 95%, that puts us ahead of the five-year average of 92%, but slightly behind the pace of harvest in 2020 when 97% of the acreage had been cut by November 21st.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says only three major producing states have not yet reached the 90% mark for corn harvested.
Michigan, 85% harvested, Ohio at 84%, and moving just out of the heart of the Corn Belt into Pennsylvania, 86% harvested.
Meanwhile, the list of states completely done with their corn harvests has increased.
It's still southern states, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas all finished.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Vietnamese government made a recent announcement that benefited U.S. grain farmers. Chad Smith has more.
Vietnam revised its most favored nation tariff rates on imports of corn, wheat, and even frozen pork. Ryan LeGrand is president and CEO of the U.S. Grains Council, and he says that's very good news.
Their government has lowered the corn tariff from 5% down to 2%, and we are now on par with all other nations that export corn to Vietnam. And that tariff put us at a disadvantage. We were at a disadvantage to Brazil and to Argentina, and now we're not. As long as we're competitive, and we have been in the last couple of years, we've been competitive. We've seen that with our increased corn exports. As long as we're there in the money, we'll get the business, and I think we'll get more business than we have in the past.
He talks about what Vietnamese buyers like about U.S. corn.
Well, they like the consistency. They like the reliability. They like to know that when they order a vessel, it's going to get there on time, and we are the most reliable shipper in the world.
It takes a lot of hard work on both sides for something like this to happen.
You know, it takes fostering relationships. It takes building trust, and that trust with the Vietnamese government, trust with our U.S. government partners in FAS. You know, it's great to have them as a partner working in tandem to help lower these tariffs. So really, you know, it's about trust and building relationships. And in the end, Vietnam saw that by lowering this tariff, they can improve access to corn, improve the pricing into their rations, which ultimately helps their producers.
LeGrand says their Asian customers traditionally like doing business face-to-face, which meant building that trust was more challenging during 2020.
They do, and it's been difficult during the pandemic because really nothing has happened face-to-face. Vietnam has a really low vaccination rate. They have very strict controls. Really, all of Asia has strict controls on travel in and out of their countries, and you can't get into many Asian countries without a two-week quarantine. So that face-to-face portion has been very difficult. It's really impossible, but we have been able to continue the relationships that we had made prior to the pandemic, just in a virtual setting, and you just work with what you got. That's what we've all done during this last 2 years. You play the hand that was dealt.
As COVID vaccination rates improve and countries around the world reopen, LeGrand says the council is gradually getting back out to find more markets for U.S. grains. Chad Smith reporting.
Want to really sabotage that holiday dinner you're preparing? Here are some simple things that could do just that. Gary Crawford reports.
And now, holiday turkey dinner no-nos. No, that's right, Mariah. We have a gravy boatload of ways to ruin our holiday dinner and perhaps experience such wondrous holiday effects as
nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, fever, chills.
Oh, goody. Holiday dinner no-nos from Meredith Carruthers with the Agriculture Department's Meat and Poultry Hotline. So, Meredith, you ready with the no-nos?
Yes.
So, what is the first no-no that many of us do that could cause a problem if we have a frozen frozen turkey.
Thawing at room temperature is definitely a big no-no. And the longer that a product, especially raw turkey, is out at room temperature, the more opportunity bacteria have to grow. And those then could create heat-resistant toxins that won't be killed by the cooking process. And then if you eat those, it could essentially make you sick. So big no-no is thawing at room temperature.
So you say instead thaw that bird in the fridge so it stays below 40 degrees, thus not allowing any bacteria to grow. Okay, next on the no list. Yes, thank you, Ringo. Meredith, you have another little no-no for us?
A big no-no.
Oh, big no-no, and that is?
Not sanitizing and cleaning your surfaces after that raw turkey might have been there.
There could be bacteria on the turkey and in the juices if they touched anything else, sink, countertop, utensils, hands, anything. Meredith says that bacteria could end up all over the kitchen and in salads and everything else. That is a big no-no.
Yes.
Ah, but wait, there's more we can do to up the risk of causing a food poisoning problem this holiday. So, there you go.
Not using a food thermometer and only relying on the pop-up timer or the way that the turkey looks is another big no-no.
That pop-up thing might let you know that the bird's up to the safe bacteria-killing temperature of 165 degrees in the spot where the pop-up is located. But turkeys are big, and Meredith says other parts of that turkey could still be below 165.
And we really recommend to check the temperature in the thickest part of the breast, the innermost part of the wing, and the innermost part of the thigh.
So not using a meat thermometer, not using it right, is another no-no. And one final major... No-no.
Not putting your leftovers away soon enough after you've eaten.
Bacteria is in the air, it's on our hands, everywhere, and if it lands on that turkey or the sliced meat while it's out on the table, it won't be too long before the bacteria start to multiply or divide or whatever they do. And so with perishable foods...
2 hours is that maximum time frame that they should be allowed to stay out for.
So those are a few of the holiday meal no-nos, which every year cause thousands of illnesses that could have been prevented. If you have questions about preparing that holiday meal, call the folks at the Meat and Poultry Hotline. Here's the number, 1-888-MP-HOTLINE, or go online to ask.usda.gov. The experts will be working even on Thanksgiving Day from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Right, Meredith?
Yes.
Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's our show for today. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.